Thank you very much. Okay. We'll get back to the meeting. We have our last session for today, impairment. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 papers. So I wonder if people are talking about issues, if they could say which paper and which, roundabout which paragraph they're talking. It's going to be quite hard to keep navigating through. So who's going to lead us off?
I will. Thank you. And welcome to our impairment session. At the September meeting, the staff started making recommendations to improve the responsiveness of the model to changes in credit risk and to clarify certain aspects of the general model. And this month, our agenda papers continue on that path of improving and clarifying the principles of the general model. We're not asking at this stage for a decision about whether you want to finalise the proposals in the exposure draft, but rather to make decisions on the assumption that you will finalise the exposure draft, and then we will deal with that at a future meeting. The recommendations that we are making in these agenda papers are clarifications and improvements mainly, so we are not suggesting or recommending any fundamental changes to the proposed model we have in the exposure draft. To start the discussion, I will start with agenda paper 5A. And this paper follows on from agenda paper 5A we discussed at the September meeting, which focused on the responsiveness of the model and the timing of the recognition of lifetime expected losses. In this paper, we are discussing 4 further issues about how to assess significant changes in credit risk and what information should be or could be taken into consideration when you make that assessment. I will talk about or introduce each of those issues separately, and I'll hand over for you to you for discussion on each of those issues so that we can try and ring fence the discussion when we talk about the separate issues. So issue A in this paper considers the feedback we have about whether lifetime expected credit losses should be recognized when there's significant increases in credit risk, and whether there are alternative approaches that could be used when assessing or making that assessment about the increases. The vast majority of respondents to our exposure draft agree that when there is a significant increase in credit risk, lifetime, that's the right point at which to recognize lifetime losses. But some made the suggestion that we should try and further align the proposals to what they are doing for credit risk management purposes. Some of the suggestions they've made we've already considered before, and that includes the, you know, assessing credit risk based on an absolute level, or using or base it on when there's a change in your credit risk management objectives. And that was proposed in the 2011 supplementary document. We also discussed in this agenda paper 2 further approaches that people have suggested, and that includes basing that assessment on the current underwriting policy of the entity, or to base it based on a counterparty assessment of credit risk. So you assess credit risk on a counterparty level. These 4 alternatives are discussed in more detail in paragraph 23-42, and staff recommendations are provided in paragraph 43-47. Now, during the field work, our participants were able to implement the proposals in the ED by looking at, or, you know, identifying an absolute level at which they would, for each specific portfolio, that they would originate assets at, or they won't originate below those levels, or maybe applying a counterparty assessment, but still linking it back to the objectives of what we had in the exposure draft. The staff recommendations on this issue is to firstly confirm that lifetime losses should be recognized when there's a significant increase in credit risk. And then secondly, to clarify that if assets are originated with a similar credit risk at initial recognition for a particular portfolio, that you could establish a level of credit risk that would be the maximum level of credit risk you would accept at initial recognition, and use that as the benchmark against which you can compare credit risk at the reporting date, instead of, you know, on a portfolio basis, instead of trying to track each of the individual assets. And the second is to clarify that applying or assessing credit risk on a counterparty level is not or could be consistent with our proposals as long as you still meet the objective. So you don't recognize lifetime losses on assets that have not shown a significant increase in credit risk. So you can use the counterparty assessment as the basis and thereafter just go back and check that it's still appropriate for all the assets that you have with that specific customer. And with that, I will ask whether you agree with the staff recommendation on this issue.
Really,
I would like to return to the discussion we initiated at the beginning of the week on the counterparty assessment. I understand the problematics that if you immediately recognize full lifetime expected credit loss on an instrument because another one with the same counterparty is considered as having deteriorated, you may have an excess allowance if you properly price the more recent instrument. I can understand that. But I think at the minimum I would say if one facility granted to a borrower has increased in credit risk such that you recognize full lifetime, it should trigger an assessment of what is the risk situation with all instruments with the same counterparty, and a review of whether the pricing of the most recent ones do actually cover the increase in risk. Not necessarily recording an allowance on the full lifetime, but at least having another look at whether it was properly priced given the new level of risk. Because in many cases, the most recent instrument might not have been priced in such a way as to reflect the new level of credit risk. So I think the solution would be somewhere in between an automatic recognition of full lifetime and just ignoring the counterparty risk level. You understand what I mean? And by the way, I think that for prudential reporting purposes, as far as I know, there is some consolidation of the risk when reporting to the prudential authority with the same counterparty in many jurisdictions at least. And so the information is available. There is some consolidation of the riskiness at the counterparty level. Maybe not everywhere, but in many jurisdictions. So the information will be available, and it should not be too difficult to do this exercise of having a look at the other instruments with the same counterparty.
Stephen.
I mean, I'm sympathetic to being careful and making sure that everything that's deteriorated is captured as an allowance, but isn't that inherent in the model itself? I'm not quite sure what else is, why this is necessary when it is required for everything.
You may have two portfolios, each one containing one instrument with a same counterparty. In one of the portfolios, you have indication of increase in risk, so you have this assessment, and possibly you classify the instrument with to the bucket 2 or whatever we call it. And I just say that the riskiness of the other portfolio might not capture that in this portfolio, you have this instrument, which becomes risky because of the assessment you made of the borrower in the other portfolio. And I'm sure there is an automatic effect today. So what I'm trying to say is that having noted an increase in risk to such a level that you consider full lifetime expected credit loss on one instrument should trigger a review of all instruments wherever they are located, whether it's bucket 1, bucket 2, or whatever. It's just a warning signal, it's kind of a red flag saying that should trigger a review. It may be that the system will automatically produce it may be not.
I think a review is fine, if that's what you're saying, because I think that's what, you know, that would be a sensible approach. I think what we don't want to do, or what at least so the model is proposed wouldn't do, would say that it would necessarily be the case that if a facility to a particular borrower was at lifetime, all of them should be. And I don't think that's what you're saying. But
no, absolutely not. I'm saying you trigger a question mark. Question mark, was this most recent instrument properly priced to reflect the new level of risk that I know today? Might be yes, maybe not.
Yeah. Particularly if you get these kind of policies.
Yes, I just would like to echo Philippe. We have to be careful about what is happening in the real life. When you make the second loan to the first, on top of the first one, normally banks would like to secure total cash flow from that counterparty. So therefore, there is often the case the pricing is not arm's length, could be much preferable than the first one, so that the entire cash flow from that counterparty could be secured. So in this sense, I think to introduce counterparty notion is really important, and I appreciate your second proposal is an improvement. However, it is not really clear. And to me, to think about the management basis, the change from portfolio basis to management basis is a kind of turning point. And when you have a portfolio loan, but if you find something to be care, and when you make the second loan, which is not really arm's length basis, and you have to monitor that loan, then this is the different stage. So such kind of notion could be introduced in our proposal.
Martin, on issue one, when the staff is proposing here to establish then the method which then entity can say, okay, what is the initial maximum credit risk accepted, and then compare that with the current credit risk, and then based on the past that level, they can judge, okay, that it is okay, then significantly deteriorated. I'm not so sure if that is a good method, because if I'm thinking, maybe that is a good method, or a method if you are in a static environment, but we are not in this dynamic environment, and I don't know if an entity can really, from the beginning of the origination, then have all kind of scenarios, what is the development of unemployment, house price, or whatever. And based on that, then saying, okay, I will accept that level of credit risk, and if that level is passed, I will move to lifetime. I think maybe it is for some easy, but I think I have the fear that somebody will then take that and ignore really then the dynamic development of an environment, and uses then our guidance maybe as an excuse that he has that done up on origination. I think that is maybe a method which we people can do if it is appropriate, but I think we should not specifically say that is an appropriate method, because I'm fearing, as we had with the 30 days past due, that it is a kind of evening, but people will misuse it. And because nobody can now say, okay, what is the accepted credit risk based on what happens in 2 years' time, because there are so many moving parts, I find it difficult. So I would caution that we give some kind of this guidance here that people can do that. If they feel it appropriate, maybe they include it, but we should not say that, because I think people will misunderstand it and not probably apply that.
Do you think, Martin, that rather than sort of trying to repeat words like we've got on the board paper and the final document, which I don't think was necessarily what we meant, but if we had an example that illustrated how it could work, making it very clear that it's satisfying the objectives of the model.
In some situations it can work, right, but my fear is in other situations maybe it's not appropriate.
Not just making too much of a big deal of it.
Yeah.
And I don't think we necessarily meant that all of the issues we discuss in this paper will end up in detailed guidance or specific requirements. It is more if we can agree on what would be or would not be consistent, we can incorporate that either through examples or just a short description or something like that. So it's not necessarily going to be, you know, this is what the requirements are.
Pat. A couple points. I guess I didn't read the suggestion in B, to question B, 1B, as strictly, I think, as Martin was. I like this recommendation. It said could be implemented, and I think it could be a nice expedient to getting to the objective. So in general, I support all the recommendations here, the staff. A couple of things. We say in the introduction that we're going to talk about when to recognize lifetime ECL in this paper. And the question that I'm curious about is whether or not we feel that you can only go, and maybe this is a topic for another paper because you talk about what this paper doesn't address. Can you only go to lifetime when there's a significant change in, you know, using the words that we have in here, significant increases in credit risk? Is it only confined to that scenario? Is a question I think we need to address at some point in time. But another point that I think needs to be emphasized here is you don't wait until there's significant increases in credit risk to increase your allowance. In other words, within bucket one, there should be adjustments. And I think sometimes some people think that there's this ability to just kind of sit tight and wait till you reach that tipping point, and that's not what we intended. So I think that needs to be emphasized. So in general, I like where you're going.
Probably similar to what Pat said, I support what's in the proposal here. I thought about Philippe's concern, but I was actually fairly comfortable with the requirement that we need to take into account current information. Whenever you are looking at, would mean that some of the current information might be counterparty risk on other loans, so that was something you were taking into account anyway. I'm a little bit concerned about tax issue that he specifically raised, because it sounds to me, tax, like what you're talking about is actually advancing a loan at an off-market rate. And that seems to me something we wouldn't want to pick up necessarily in the impairment guidance so much as in the value of the loan at the date of advancing it. Mm-hmm. So I am concerned that we incorporate anything that suggests that that's an impairment rather than an off-market loan. I just want to confirm my understanding of the portfolio one after Marty's comments. The way that I thought about the portfolio one, the maximizing, is that in essence what you would do is as you advance let's say a home loan, you would place an internal rate on that home loan, let's say 10, you would allocate that to the 10 portfolio. If it improved over time, that's great, because there would be lots of things in that portfolio that might be 9s or 8s or 7s. But if it declined, it would go below the level to 11. That meant that you wouldn't need to track those loans. You could forget about them completely. And all you'd be doing is assessing whether any of those loans at any point in time were 11. It seems to me that's relying on the rating scale. It removes the need for tracking, so you don't have to worry about tracking. There might be more portfolios than otherwise. But I'm not sure that requires an advanced understanding of what the various elements like employment and et cetera are. It simply says whatever the scale is that I apply at that point in time, if it is less than 10, or if it's worse than 10, I regard it as bad. If it's better than 10, I regard it as good. Am I understanding it right?
Yes, that is what the intention was. Is that you initially, if you can allocate loans or a portfolio of loans to a specific loan, they generally originate at the level 6 or 7, and you know that by the time it gets to 8, that does mean, you know, there has to be significant increases. So it takes away some of the burden about tracking the individual assets.
So, I mean, it means in essence what you're suggesting is that rather than track each individual asset, you simply allocate the asset to a portfolio, and then you just look from time to time at that portfolio to see whether something is out of sync with it.
Yeah.
Mary.
I think it cuts across both of these issues, and it's a how we convey these thoughts rather than what to do. Sorry, let me back up and say support the staff's recommendations in question one. What I mean by how we communicate is for the two things that we've been discussing, mostly the counterparty, but also the idea about maximum credit risk in a portfolio. I think they're operational techniques that we came to understand in part through field work, and we want to share the knowledge and point out to people ways that they might want to consider doing things if it fits, you know, with their system as a way for reducing the burden. And I think if we can capture them and characterize them that way, great to share the knowledge and leverage the experience. We just should not write them into the standard in a way that implies that they are either, I can't remember what the term is, operational simplifications, that we're giving relief for these are alternatives. It's not like we're blessing the method and say, if you apply this method, then it's okay whether or not it meets the objective. We're just saying, hey, having field tested, here's some ideas that people came up with about ways to comply to meet the objective. You may find them useful. And we believe that, you know, if you can implement them, it might reduce the burden. I think that kind of information sharing, great, but let's not put it in the document in a way that implies that it's a safe harbor. If you do this, you're fine, whether or not it meets the objective.
Yeah, and that was not our intention to do it that way. Yeah.
Amaha.
That's almost the same idea as Mary just expressed it. And I was quite comfortable with the staff's recommendation. I think as it comes to the counterpart, that if I apply the general model, I think it will lead me to the same response. But then I guess Rihanna commented in the beginning that we should not include too much guidance, and then to be perceived as the process that should be followed in order to be aligned with the requirement in this. So it's again, it's a principle based, it's entity specific. So I think sharing through examples or in the implementation guidance or even only describing the base for conclusion as a result of our learning curve during this process would be great, but not overemphasize one system, one model, one process, because then this is not really aligned with this main objective of this project.
Yeah.
Martin.
Yeah, one small appointment. On paragraph 51, D, also with this rising. And there is a word that a significant increase in credit risk may be occurred when rates or terms of existing financial instruments would be different. Couldn't it be a significant difference? Because otherwise, I think maybe some regulators and auditors will say, okay, if the credit spread is increased by one basis point, then it's clearly okay based on this guidance, it is a significant deterioration.
Yes, but are you now on ECB?
Yeah.
Are
we?
Ready?
No.
But you're right on the point.
Okay.
Carol, you're right.
Take a page out of my book.
Okay.
I think you're using the new junior
word on the same page.
I can talk about offsetting though again if you want.
Okay, if we go to issue one, everybody happy with A, B, and C?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Good. Well, we can move on then.
Okay, so ECB. ECB considers the question we asked our respondents whether the proposals provide sufficient guidance on how and when to assess significant increases in credit risk. And although a lot of our respondents agree with that, you know, there's sufficient guidance or they made suggestions on how to improve that, what they in particular commented on was that they perceive the exposure draft to require the explicit use of a probability of default approach in measuring or assessing significant increases in credit risk. And the other question was whether, and that touches on the point that Martin just raised, whether some of the indicators that is listed in paragraph B20 of the exposure draft, some of those indicators would be a stronger indication of an increase in credit risk, or whether some of those indicators should carry a bigger weight in making the assessment. From a staff perspective, we believe that the intention was not to require the explicit use of a probability of default for the PD approach, or requiring entities to apply a very mechanistic approach in assessing credit risk, but rather that what they should consider is
the risk of a default. So, you know, what is the risk that a default will occur, assessed at the initial recognition and then changes in that risk going forward. We also believe that it is not appropriate to state that some indicators are stronger or carry more weight when assessing credit risk, but rather that, you know, credit risk assessment or the analysis is a more holistic approach and it's multidimensional, so entities should look at what is the relevant requirements from our, pick the relevant requirements out of that list rather than prescribing which ones they should consider. And so with that, I'll leave it to you for comment.
Matt, did you want to revisit your point?
No, I think everybody has understood.
I've just forgotten it.
Pat, I like the staff suggestions here, but I felt that the use of the word could in A, B, and C, in 51 A, B, and C, was a little bit too weak in terms of the way we're trying to steer use of relevant indicators. And I think at the end of the day, one of the outcomes we don't want here is that the preparer essentially chooses to ignore information because they say, well, that's possible, but it's possible it's really not all that a prominent concern or issue right now. So the use of the word could, I think, leaves a lot more leeway for that, and I think we want to emphasize should here. The other point I would say is that as we lead through this list of indicators in the actual ED, I actually think there needs to be more weight placed on market observable observations, and over time, I think they need to take precedence. So, you know, if you go a year, 2-3 years down the road, and you have prices of assets that are, you know, well below where they originally were priced and recorded, it really begs the question as to whether or not you're using the evidence in the marketplace. So yeah, it is entity specific, but if you want to have some credibility with the market, I think you need to weigh those types of indicators at least as much, if not more so than other indicators.
I had a little worry on 51A. We sort of got require and relevant. I guess I'd just say there should be indicators that are relevant, because that's got to make the selection of work for them. It's wording, I'm sure. Any other comments? No, everybody agrees with question 2? 14-0. Issue C.
Yes, I think we can take issue C and D together.
Okay.
So issue C considers the feedback we have whether the assessment of significant increases in credit risk, whether that should only be based on changes in the risk of default or the probability of a default occurring, or whether that should also take into account changes in the amount or the severity of a loss. And the second part of that is whether, when making your assessment of changes in credit risk, whether you should only, whether there is circumstances in which the 12-month probability of a default occurring or the risk of that default could be appropriate to use instead of having to make a lifetime assessment of the credit risk. The staff recommendation is to confirm the proposals in exposure draft that your assessment of changes in credit risk should take into account changes in the risk of that default occurring or the probability of that default. But there could be cases where changes in the value of, let's say, collateral could be an indicator of changes or significant increases in credit risk. So it should not, it could be one of the things that you consider, but it should not drive or be the only indicator that you consider for increases. On the second question, we recommend that, similar to the guidance that's already in the exposure draft saying 12-month expected losses could sometimes be appropriate, to use as part of your assessment, just a slight change in the words to say that 12 months would be appropriate to use unless your circumstances indicate that a lifetime assessment is necessary. And we provide some indicators in the, or factors in the agenda paper about what those conditions would be. So if you've got a bullet loan, for example, your 12 month risk will not be sufficient to use. On issue D, the question was just whether the model should be symmetrical. So once an asset has significant increases in credit risk and it has been transferred to stage 2, whether it should be able to move back to stage 1 if credit risk has improved again. And our recommendation is that we confirm the proposals in the exposure draft, that the model is fully symmetrical. And with that, we can discuss both of those issues together.
Yeah. Issue D, very quickly, I'm in full agreement, so I have no observation on that. On issue C, this is an issue, as you know, I lost after a very hard-fought battle. But I would say the following. While it is true that an increase in LGD may be or could be an indication of an increase in probability of default, it doesn't have to be. So you can have increases in LGD, and they may not be increases in probability of default along the horizon, for example, that management is taking. It would be very unfortunate, in my opinion, that that is the information or evidence that's ignored in coming up with your expected loss. And this would be particularly the case when you're dealing with below investment grade assets, really low level speculative grade type assets, where a company could be sitting on significant mounds of liquidity and there is no potential chance of default, but yet the franchise is going to hell in a handbasket. And because of light covenants, no covenants, and an abundance of cash at the holding company, there'll be no default, at least in the next 2 or 3 years. So to say that there should be no increase in the EL there, in my opinion, would lead you to the wrong conclusion.
And I don't think, because even the exposure draft said that when you do your measurement of your expected losses, so when you measure your loss allowance, you need to take into account the value of the collateral. So changes in the value of that collateral, regardless of whether your
risk has increased. Let's say it's unsecured and there is no collateral.
Well, in that case, you'd still adjust your, I think, from a measurement perspective, you'd still consider the change in the loss given default.
But the words don't say that, though.
Okay. All we're trying to say is it wouldn't in itself cause a movement to lifetime. But you would still update your EL for change in LGD. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Fair enough. If the words say that,
yeah,
I'm very comfortable.
Yeah, that's what we mean. Sorry.
Okay.
Sure,
but it remains in stage 1, though.
Yeah.
Well, in this particular case, you know, if you have any kind of significant in LGD in stage 1, I would think it's probably going to bump you to stage 2. I'm more concerned, frankly, about the things that are already in stage 2, where you're measuring your EL at an inflated level because you're not adequately taking into consideration movements in LGD.
No, you need to look at that. You have to update that.
But the way it's worded, the way I think the staff is thinking of this, is only when it's an indication of an increase in PD.
No. Always update.
And they could be very much, you know.
All we were trying to clarify here is that in the case where a change in the value of the collateral, so a change in the value of your LGD.
Yeah, assume there's no collateral.
But if
many loans are unsecured.
Yeah, but a change in the value of your LGD could be an indication of a change in risk or an increase in risk. But when you assess your increase in risk, it should still be based on, so when you transfer something to stage 2, it should still be based on a change in that risk of a default occurring. So we're not, you should take any change in LGD should be reflected in your measurement. We're just saying it could be an indication that there is a move from stage 1 to 2.
We'll
Mary.
Again, like Pat, let me deal with issue D. Pat, agree with the proposal to verify symmetry, the ability to return to 12 months if conditions approve. It's really around issue C. I guess I had a bit of a question whether we did indeed want to give people the safe harbor of saying to avoid having, sorry, I'm looking at paragraph 67, to avoid having to prove that the outcome would not differ, and say it's 12 months unless you have you can use the 12 month horizon unless events indicate otherwise. Shouldn't that be more the kind of hints we've learned or tips that you may want to think of when you have loans that you could assess on this basis, and pointing out the characteristics that you've listed in sub-bullet B about when that may be the case, and maybe supplementing it by saying you don't have to do that. It probably will not be necessary to do this on an instrument-by-instrument basis. You may be able to do it for portfolios or products or types of loans, but I don't know that we want to say set it up in such a way, because this will then bake in an operational simplification that I think sends a safe harbor message that says you get to use 12 months unless somebody, in the extreme, unless somebody bangs you over the head with a piece of evidence that says this is why 12 months is not the right horizon to use. I think we can capture the learning, but here we're offering not just an idea of how you might want to do it, but we're giving the staff, to me, what the staff is proposing in paragraph 67 is actually verging on safe harbor.
And I actually thought that the intent in the exposure draft was that this was, in fact, the safe harbor. This was an expedient that we'd given.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this simply reflects almost the status quo under the exposure draft, doesn't it?
Our final word.
Yes.
Yeah. It wasn't even the safe harbor, I think, in the exposure draft.
Ah.
Okay.
It is already in paragraph B11 of the ED.
Okay.
And the only reason we are clarifying it is that the feedback we've received indicated that people really to say you have to do both. So you have to do a 12-month assessment, you have to do a lifetime assessment to prove that your 12-month assessment is representative of changes in the lifetime.
Yeah.
So we're just trying to clarify, you don't have to do that unless...
Okay.
So
I had not remembered that, and I feel I'm still kind of learning curve. I don't know that I was here at the beginning, I would have been in favor of that, but if it's where we were.
Martin. Yes. Yeah, because I'm on the same issue. I think that is very, very important, because if you imagine, for example, if banks have a 10-year loan, and if we don't allow that, they have to really, on origination, have to say what is my probability of default in 1 year for the remaining 9 years, in 2 years for the remaining 8 years, and so on and so forth, because that is the only way then they can compare lifetime expected losses. And therefore, I think that is very important to make the model operational. And I wanted to say what we have said in paragraph 66, that really the intention of the IFB was not to require entities to do both 12 months and lifetime. I think that should be really in the basis of conclusion of that, to make it crystal clear. Because otherwise, I think very hard for people to do that.
Okay. I wanted to comment on Pat's point about the PD and LGD. I don't think it's a problem for assets that are already in stage two, because you've fully taken into account all available information about the expected loss and you update it. There is potentially an issue in the transfer from stage one to stage two, because you could conceive of a situation where an asset has the same PD from one period to the next, but the LGD goes up. And that is potentially a problem where there's an inconsistency between what we say in terms of the assessment and the description we give of its deterioration in credit quality means that you would have priced it differently. Well, if the LGD is different but the PD is the same, you would have priced it differently. I'm happy with where we are because of the operational aspect of it. I think it would be too difficult to go to the expected loss as the basis for transfer, and also on the basis that I think it is likely that if the LGD has changed, then the PD has probably changed as well. But I think we need to be clear when we talk about this as to exactly what we mean, and particularly when we use the phrase would have been priced differently, given that that doesn't exactly correlate with our reliance on PD.
Where are you reading, Steve, where it says it would have been priced differently?
That's a phrase that we've used in the past. It's not in the paper, but it's a phrase that we've used.
If you make the change that I think Sue said, I think captures my point and Stephen's point. And you're absolutely right. The real critical issue is really at stage one. I'm also concerned at stage two, though, because I've seen this happen numerous times, where companies have covenant line arrangements, they have lots of liquidity, and yet the franchise is deteriorating, and you wouldn't necessarily, if you do a strict application of this model, go to lifetime loan.
Chang Wu.
Yes, Chair, thank you. On this discussion, maybe I would like to suggest if you see the paragraph 53, there are two paragraphs of our EV, listed in paragraph 8 and the paragraph B11. So comparing these two paragraphs, you know, I would like to suggest to you for their maybe the amount of expected credit loss, and however you may use probably the default, because it's a kind of difficult tracking or kind of change in amount of expected credit losses. If you see paragraph B11, the structure of the whole paragraph is using the default approach and their kind of permissible approach as a practical experience. So that's why I'm suggesting they have to change paragraph 8 like paragraph B11.
Are you talking about paragraph in the exposure draft?
Yes. That's in paragraph 53, you're in the agent paper now.
Finish.
I do agree with the general direction for question C and D, but like Steve and Pat, I think the wording that we have now in paragraph 79, little A, is too negative, because it says, confirm that the assessment of when to recognize last NCL should consider only changes in the PD. You are prohibited under this wording to look at the evolution in the LGD. I think we should say it should be based on the PD, and then explain that the change in LGD might be an indicator of a change in the PD. But as it is today, it's just prohibiting.
But sorry. We are talking here about this assessment of when to recognize. I think Philippe's question is much more on the measurement side.
No. You are assessing a change in the PD. Mm-hmm. Which would trigger or not a movement to full ECL, okay?
Yeah.
In assessing the change in the PD, here it says only look at the PD.
Yeah.
And not look at LGD, in parenthesis. You have to ignore the change in LGD for looking at the change in the PD. I think it's wrong. A change in LGD can be an indicator of a change in PD.
I understand what you mean. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. We can look at that.
Okay. Any further comments? Everybody in favor of question 3?
Yep.
Question 4?
Yep.
Okay, we'll move on.
So, paper 5 presents two of the operational simplifications the board introduced into the exposure draft, namely, that there is a rebuttable presumption that the credit risk has significantly increased for a financial instrument over its remaining life when the contractual payments are more than 30 days past due. And secondly, that the entity need not assess full significant increase in credit risk as long as the instrument is low credit risk. This agenda paper discusses the feedback we received and areas for clarifications on these two simplifications. There are a number of issues that we will discuss, so we thought it best that I discuss each issue on its own and open the floor for discussions as we go through the paper. First, looking at the more than 30 days past due presumption. The majority of respondents supported this inclusion of this rebuttable presumption. They argued that it is in line with their credit risk management, and that because delinquency is already a lagging indicator, a longer period would not be appropriate. In contrast, the opponents to those proposals said that it's a lagging indicator and were scared that a lot of preparers would actually rely on the more than 30 days spot due in isolation, disregarding any other forward-looking information. Secondly, a lot of them also argued that the 30 days past due is too early an indicator and instead should be later because of the volatility that is caused between the back and forth moving between stage 1 and 2. On the presumption being rebuttable, there were mixed views.
We believe, however, that it would not be appropriate to have all instruments moved from lifetime expected credit losses when the contractual payments are more than 30 days past due, because it's not always indicative of the increase in a significant increase in credit risk. The SARC recommends, therefore, that the board keep the rebuttable presumption that there is a significant increase in credit risk when the contractual payments are more than 30 days past due. But we propose to clarify that the objective of the rebuttable presumption is to serve as a backstop, identifying those instruments that have experienced a significant increase in credit risk. Secondly, that the presumption is meant to result in the recognition of lifetime expected credit losses before there is objective evidence of impairment. And lastly, that an entity can rebut this presumption where it has reasonable and supportable information that the 30 days past due is not the point where significant increase in credit risk arises. At that point, I open the floor.
Philippe, you go first.
I agree with the proposal. I just think we have a communication issue and we need to reconcile that proposal with what I'm reading from the press, that the European Banking Authority is proposing to harmonize definition of bad debt, doubtful receivables, based on 90 days past due. 90 days past due would trigger a classification as bad debt under the
stage 3.
That would be stage 3, exactly. That's probably where we need to reconcile and to explain. We are talking here between stage 1 and stage 2, and I think there are that people who responded to our consultation probably were influenced by that view and did not get maybe the point that there are 3 stages, and I think that we need to explain clearly.
I think and that's a valid point, because I think what happened, and we noted this in the paper, is that sometimes when people said 30 days was too early, it's not the right date, they often said, oh, because this is not what we use today as objective evidence of impairment. And I think we are highlighting again that moving to stage 2 is not impairment indicative, it's just indicative of significant increase in credit risk.
Pat, you were next.
I guess 30 days is the absolute minimum I'd want to go on this. I agreed with everything that you said, Phil. Maximum. I'm sorry.
Happy you on that.
But the reason why I even pause as to whether or not it should be a rebuttable presumption, I think it should be an automatic. And that is, in other words, they shouldn't be given the permission to rebut the presumption. Notwithstanding the fact that in some countries you might have 180 days to consider something to be timely. The reason is because the reason why we're introducing this is we're acknowledging that some entities in some regions don't have a sophisticated credit risk management system. So you're already looking in the rearview mirror. Your problems are probably a lot worse than 30 days when you get around to booking something, if you're going to use 30 days. So I know what my colleague from South Africa is going to say in a minute, but notwithstanding what he's going to say, this is too generous. A rebuttable presumption is too generous. 30 days, you know, I mean, assuming that there was an error, obviously, in the system, goes to lifetime.
Okay. Stephen, you were.
It seems to me that part of the reason we have this is to manage implementation. It's not really part of the standard. It's not affecting the allowance. If somebody implements the principle correctly, would it make any difference whether this 30 days past due within the standard or not? I don't think it would. To my mind, it's more of a, you know, I put it in an auditing manual. Because if management has got a portfolio assets which are more than 30 days past due, you want to go and question them, well, why haven't you got an allowance? So I mean, it's not something I'm going to object to particularly, although I do worry whether it actually might be counterproductive and encourage more of a delay.
That's right.
But is it really necessary in an accounting standard to have this?
I think maybe to Philippe's point, it's helpful in the sense that if people are getting confused by what we mean about when you go to stage 2 and they think that we're talking about default, by sending the signal that it's an earlier thing like, you know, 30 days past due, which may well not ultimately lead to default, it just I think it does, and I know there's dangers with rebuttal presumptions, but I think it does help provide that signal that it's an early and it's an earlier point in the life.
Whereabouts is this going to be in the standard? At the moment, it's in the main body of the standard.
Where is it going to end up? Is it going to stay there?
Well, are you proposing to make it education guidance?
I mean,
when we get there, I suspect we'll think about it. But would you be more comfortable with that?
Well, as I said, I might be more comfortable if it's in the audit manual.
Steve, if we delete at all, will you form similar conclusion with that?
If you delete at all,
that's point you have, like, I make it automatic, no rebuttable.
Yeah. No, I don't think you can do that.
We'll not make it 30 days at all.
Yeah. Well, then
you could have 300 days test due and it could still be current.
Nothing.
No, stage one. If you have a principle, we've got to trust people to apply the principle.
Do we?
Well, that's the reason why, presumably, we've got the 30 days, because we don't entirely trust people to apply the principle.
Yeah. I think I'm probably just building now on what Steve said. To my mind, we have a principle, we know what the principle is. We put a rule in at the end, a 30-day rule, to say that if you hit 30 days, and possibly it is because we don't necessarily entirely... Well, I think we do trust the process, so hopefully most of the time people won't hit the 30 days. The 30 days is in there. But my concern with what Pat's saying is that because it is a rule, there are going to be circumstances where it's not relevant. Circumstances where, for example, you have a particular, and I think I've mentioned in the past, in some countries, municipalities that are notoriously late in paying, but they have a government guarantee, so they always pay in the end. Now, do you really want those to be going in and out of bad debt, even though you know with absolute certainty they always pay?
No, but they should be lifetime. They should be measured at lifetime.
Why would it go to lifetime?
Because they're a higher risk credit.
There is no deterioration.
When they take that long to pay, they're a higher risk credit.
In the example of, and this to an extent would be applicable also in trade credit type situations, you very often find that the very big companies carry enough buying power to be able to deliberately pay late. They always pay at 60 days instead of 30 days. Do you want to force those in?
So I can understand why we put a rule in place, but I think if you put a rule in place, you have to have some kind of relief valve on that rule.
Gary.
Yeah, so I'm going to build on what my South African colleague told my New York City colleague and his upstate New York colleagues and some of the same thing. 30 days is fine. I think it should be rebuttable. And when companies or your balance of trade or balance of payments with each other as both a customer and a vendor, they put all sorts of leverage terms on in downstream negotiations unrelated to anything. And they're going to pay, they're going to perform, but until you see this negotiation on something unrelated my way, I'm sitting on your cash. So I think rebuttable is perfectly fine. And if it's easy to rebut, if it's really 60 days is sort of the linchpin. Well, it's not going to be hard to document a policy that says we don't worry about it before it's 60 days. That's your rebutting. You know, if it's a problem, well, then we won't be able to rebut it.
Martin. Yeah, man, I think the 30 days past due is okay, but it's okay as a backstop. And I think when we say, okay, it is a kind of simplification, then many people think, okay, if I only look at that 30 days past due, that is okay. And that was okay, what we discussed, I think, in September is not okay. We will clarify that. But here in under paragraph 9, I think I would recommend to delete B, because if we say that it is meant to result in recognition of lifetime EZL before there is an objective evidence of impairment, that would suggest that 30 days past due is not an objective evidence of impairment. But based on our discussion, maybe some people will define default already at 30 days past due. You can define, and then you have objective evidence as impairment in this regard. So it all depends really on the definition of default. And I would recommend really for that reason to delete B in this, because it doesn't add anything. And from my perspective, it really goes in the opposite direction, that people will say, okay, but 30 days past due is
not really shown an indicator where it isn't, could be an objective evidence of already an impairment. Okay. Some people may think they're different. Maybe they think, okay, if I have passed 30 days past due, I'm already in stage three.
And I don't think we were saying that, you know, it could never be objective evidence of impairment. It is just that trying to support why we're saying it's a backstop and why it's a rebuttable presumption is that we want to recognize lifetime losses before you get to default. So
yes,
the 30 days was meant to transfer the assets to stage two.
I agree with that. We should say A and C, but delete B. That is what I think. Because B is not adding to this notion that we want
but
to...
In when drafting B and expanding what Rihanna said, the intention was we need to make sure that when someone rebuts, that they rebut for the right reason. And I think the fear from the comments is people think rebutting is very easy because they'll just rebut and say, well, we do 60 days. And some would say, well, because today I do 60 days for impairment. And we are trying to capture that when rebutting, the objective is not to move to a point of objective evidence of impairment, it's to move to a point of significant increase in credit risk. Now, I do take your point of some have some sunset, well, they consider 30 days to be objective evidence of impairment, but then I would expect them to identify significant increase in credit risk before 30 days.
But in September, we said, okay, that is a lagging indicator, 30 days, but we want to have the whole model more forward-looking, right? And if we now say, okay, but the 30 days we can use because there is an objective evidence there before an objective evidence of impairment, but that is already a lagging factor which has some objective evidence of impairment. And people can interpret that they don't have to look more forward-looking and do other things into account. That is my fear, if we have this B in the standard. Mary?
Despite my comments on the previous paper about, you know, capturing the knowledge learning from field tests and putting that as helpful hints rather than in the text, I think this is one that we need in the text of the standard. I very much agree with the staff's view that we have to make clear that 30 days past due is not a safe harbor in the sense that you can say, they've given me permission to use 30 days past due, so I don't have to think about what other evidence there is that might be more relevant and do that. And I think we have to clarify that, because that was my sense from the summary of field work that some had thought, I can just use 30 days past due and that absolves me from thinking about anything else. The reason I think that we need it in the standard, and I would support it being rebuttable, is that we have said an entity determines what the markers are for evidence of significant credit deterioration. And we're saying because we're relying on entities to make that judgment, we're saying this is the backstop. And you can't go further than this in your indicator.
Nothing more.
And so that's why it's not a safe harbor, but that's why we need it in the standard, because it's our backstop to allowing a range of practices rather than saying you're trying to find X. So I think I'd stick with the staff recommendation.
Stephen? Just on this 9B again. I think the problem is you're using the phrase objective evidence of impairment, which is an IS 39 phrase. Because when IS 39 goes, that phrase goes, in my mind,
not so far, because
it's in Appendix A of the
stage. Well, in that case, we ought to think about changing that phrase to stage three, because objective evidence of impairment in the future is surely going to be deterioration.
Well, no, because remember we were using stage three entered on that so that people could use the systems they've got in place now.
No, I'm not objecting to using exist. So you want to keep the phrase.
Yeah.
Well, then we'll have to okay, then is the phrase defined?
Yes, in Appendix A of the ED.
But we're going to discuss that when we get the stage three discussions later on, so maybe then we can look at then whether it makes sense to still use that phrase here.
Okay. I found the phrase confusing.
Yeah.
Just quickly, Ian, on this, is it just it takes a reminder to remember that this is a term of art. This has a very specific meaning that means this is an incurred loss rather than an expectation. And maybe when we are talking about it in the text of when you move from stage one to stage two, we should be saying before there is an incurred loss. I think we're trying to apply to the stage three, but you have to remember that every one of those words has that phrase has a very specific meaning that means later.
Okay. Any more comments on this particular issue? Do we have a question on this issue?
Yes.
Which question is it?
So it's the question on page 10. So there's two questions I'd like to ask. First, does the board agree to carry forward the rebuttable presumption that there is a significant increase in credit risk when the contractual payments are more than 30 days past due?
Yes.
Okay. And then second...
I don't agree with it.
I don't agree either. Two. Any others don't agree? Sorry? Any others don't agree? Any
12 and 2.
And then secondly, does the ISB agree with the clarifications as in paragraph 29?
So that's the
hang on. Okay.
I mean, so Martin, do you disagree or agree?
Sorry?
Did you agree or disagree?
I disagree. I would agree if he deletes B, then I would agree.
Because I disagree with
you. You do B?
No. Anybody else disagree? Okay. 31. Okay, move on.
Okay, so the second bit is looking at the low credit risk. The board also introduced a simplification to say that an entity does not need to assess for significant increase in credit risk for financial assets that are low credit risk at reporting day. Accordingly, the entity would continue to recognize the 12-month expected losses allowance on these assets. The proposals further included a description of low credit risk and then an example to illustrate what it means with that by using investment grade. Respondents were mixed in their feedback on these proposals. In addition, all respondents asked for a number of clarifications. Respondents that supported the proposals argued that it reduces the operational burden and that it would not be appropriate to recognize full lifetime expected credit losses on high-quality instruments. In contrast, those that opposed the proposal stated that there is no clear notion of low credit risk and the downgrades within investment grade can reflect significant increases in credit risk. And lastly, that in some cases the exemption results in actual and operational burden due to the additional layer of the assessment. In addressing the feedback, we believe it's best to first clarify what the ISB means with low credit risk before considering to keep it or to remove it. In light of the feedback, we recommend to modify the current description of low credit risk and align it more to the terminology used by the external rating agencies, which we have included in the paper. Accordingly, we recommend that low credit risk be described as instrument as having low risk of default, that in the near term the borrower has a strong capacity to meet its obligation, and in the longer term the borrower's capacity may, but won't necessarily, be reduced by adverse business and economic conditions. To illustrate what the board meant with low credit risk, it included an example of investment grade. However, the example had raised additional concerns from respondents. We accordingly recommend to clarify that the example does not require that instruments have to be externally rated to qualify as low credit risk. Secondly, in considering rating scales, we believe it is more consistent to use global rating scales as the benchmark rather than national rating scales. This is because we believe the intention is to capture investments with low risk of default that would typically be regarded as safe investments using a global benchmark. Lastly, we recommend clarifying that the move to non-investment grade is not in itself a trigger to recognize lifetime expected credit losses. Rather, an entity will then have to assess whether there has been a significant increase in credit risk. With that, I open the floor for discussion on the meaning of low credit risk.
Yeah.
Well, I,
I agree with the direction you are going, but I'm a little bit worried about the investment grade. And I think you are profiling it in the sense that if you have it, you are free. And I think it should be the other way around, that you should analyze what is a low risk to make a judgment. An indicator could be that if you have investment grade, perhaps you have a good situation. And I just took five cases, Ireland, Greece, AIG, Lehman and Northern Rock. They were all investment grade just before they collapsed. While perhaps in some cases you could have said that, well, they are investment grade, but the circumstances are such that it's still a high risk, or not a low risk. And therefore I think the wording around this must be more open-minded for saying that you can have investment grade and still be in difficulty.
Yes, I think, as I said, I think definitely the focus is not that investment grade is when the exemption is there. I think we're trying to illustrate with low credit risk. I think your concern gets addressed with those respondents that have said one of the reasons why they believe it might not always be appropriate to just rely on the investment grade is because they sometimes think information is lagging and they would want to more quickly update it. So I think it's illustrating the concept of more or less what low credit risk means.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think the important is that it's written sort of that you can have investment grade and still be in jeopardy of losing money. Not the other way around. You are safe if you have investment grade.
Do you disagree with the way it is set out in the exposure draft as well, where in the ED it sort of says, well, you're safe as long as you're in low credit risk. You don't have to assess whether that increase has been significant because we will assume that it's not. So you don't have to assess the increase. You only have to assess it when you move out of low credit risk.
Can I try and... I think Jan is concerned about a situation where the external credit rating agencies have it as investment grade, but the entity's own assessment is that it's higher risk.
Yeah. Or they don't do an assessment because they have the external assessment.
And this goes back to my point about weighing market indicators when there's clear evidence.
It's still consistent. I think, just on that, so I think it's if the entity assesses that it's low credit risk, so it's not constrained by that external rating if it thinks otherwise. But I think the reality will be, just to be sure we're all on the same page, that it might be the case that you don't have any more of your own information that's reasonable and supportable to think other than the external rating. But we certainly don't want to stop somebody saying, actually, I think my assessment is different to what the external rating has. I agree with that.
Why do?
You can't understand clearly the global and national rating scales. Whether we want to say a particular bond or loan but too late, one is rated by local agency and loan by international agency, then you should use international one?
No, usually it would be, let's say, one of the big international, so let's take S&P for example. They have what they call a global scale rating and a national scale rating. Now, not every country in the world has got national scale ratings. It's only for certain countries and jurisdictions where they found that appropriate. And in those jurisdictions, it depends, but they can have actually both. So that they issue. So it's not necessarily a local agency just giving the rating. That can also happen. But you get the big ones have both a global scale and a national scale, I think.
The difference takes into consideration the sovereign risk and the ability of the sovereign, its capacity to meet its external debts and obligations. The foreign currency ratings effectively would reflect that sovereign risk. National or local currency ratings would not, because essentially comparing the ratings only to entities in that sovereign entity, in that country.
I think it's quite important on this. I spent quite a lot of time reading up on how the various rating agencies do their national ratings and get an understanding of it. And I think from what I can see, there's not necessarily a consistent methodology for calculating national scale ratings, either in the local players in a particular jurisdiction or in the international players jurisdiction by jurisdiction. So I think I kind of agree with this, but I think that the example needs to be quite careful in saying that a global scale rating is certainly indicative, as I think the others referred to, is indicative that there might be low risk. Once you start looking at any other rating, you need to evaluate whether the risks that you are assessing and the methodology that the rating agency is using are actually consistent. This is having read up on it, there's a lot of inconsistency in the way national scale ratings are calculated.
I disagree using the external rating agency's terminology, and I disagree with using the word external rating agency in the draft, in the paragraph 6 of ED. Says, for example, external credit rating agency, investment grade. I said external rating agency. So we should avoid using this word, because one of the causes of the financial crisis was too much dependence on the external rating agency, and the current tendency is to avoid depending on external credit rating agency. So therefore, if we incorporate that word in our ED, it seems like our direction is completely opposite. So that's the main reason which I raised before. The other reason is same as the Wago and Darrow raised. You said that we should depend on the global scale, but the definition of global scale is not very much clear, even though after your explanation. So each jurisdiction have a local rating agency. So they may have kind of global scale rating. However, it may be quite different from the other countries' one. So that would confuse what is the global and what is the local scale. The second point is you would mix up the country risks of the customer of the financial institution and the country risk for the financial institution. So if the financial institution have a customer which has a very good rating in that country, then they can secure their loan anyway. But that financial institution may have a country risk. So for those who are investing to that financial institution, not the customer, then may take into consideration the country risk of that financial institution. But if it is out of the financial statement of that financial institution. So we are talking about the financial statement of that financial institution. So then we should not take into consideration of the country risk of that particular lender institution. So taking those things into consideration, I think to refer to the external credit rating agency damages our proposal. So we should avoid using, referring to external credit rating agency.
Two questions just on that. So in your first point that you raised of not referring to an external rating agency, because the example that we use is investment grade, when we are referring to that example, we were referring to a more market view that they took of that. So if we don't refer to external rating, I'm just curious whether we can refer to investment grade, because that example that we built was based on investment grade of an external rating agency, where the concept is low credit risk, which is not dependent on external rating agency.
All we're trying to do is to describe in a succinct way the sort of credit quality that we mean.
Yes. I don't
otherwise
disagree.
Otherwise, you're not
going to
have any sort of comparability in how
that gets
applied.
I don't disagree, introducing some expedient for the low credit risk. So therefore, I'm not 100% disagreeing your proposal itself. However, if we use the word investing grade, that is the well-known word, and it would be misunderstood. That was the point raised by Yang. And perhaps there might be a better word. I can't provide any example, but say something like underwriting notion, which was discussed in 7A, could be replacement for the wording of investing.
Everybody's underwriting standards are different by product jurisdiction day of the week.
So maybe underwriting might not be good, but so investment grade for internal purposes would be, in a sense, acceptable, but do not use the investment grade.
Well, if
because
if
totally
you want
this
to
is for internal rating purposes.
Nothing.
I think this simplification of low creditors is for me not only simplification. I think for me, when we developed the standards, it was really when the board gives some guidance, what we think, okay, when the level from credit quality changes to significant deterioration. And therefore, we said, okay, maybe we have this extension of low credit risk. And low credit risk, that some people have some idea what we mean by that, therefore we introduced, okay, maybe it is investment grade, it's low credit risk. And if we would take that away, I think nobody would have any clue what we think what low credit risk should be. Therefore, I think it is essential that we have in the standard really this kind of low credit risk, and we think, okay, low credit risk is
blah, blah, blah,
investment grade. That was my first point. My second point is, okay, but then when we're saying regarding it should be an accounting policy choice, for that it would be then very difficult, because then...
Second
bit. related to
that.
For me, the main purpose of that is not only simplification. It gives guidance, people where we think, okay, the threshold should be, when it should enter into significant deterioration. And then related to that, but if we would make them, maybe this is not the topic now, as an accounting policy choice, we will take that guidance in some way away from people. Because then people can choose by their own what they think, okay, significant deterioration is. And then maybe we have people who have already from, if it is a deterioration from AAA to AA, based on their judgment, think it's significant deterioration, and then any comparability will go away.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think all that is linked, and we really should keep this investment grade notion in, and then it's only related to this accounting policy choice. I think we should not allow that, because then it is maybe simplification is easier, but that is not the main point. I think the main point for me was low credit risk, investment grade is to give people guidance where we think somebody enters a significant deterioration.
Thank you.
Thank you. On that, maybe question related to this issue. On paragraph 57, and B, 2, and 3. So I'm suggesting how about deleting that in the near term. The reason is this is not consistent with your good analysis of outside external credit rating agencies, like the description. They just use this near term terminology for you for only triple B.
Yeah.
So if we just stick to that, if you are near term, your capacity is okay, then you can use low credit quality, a low credit risk, so you can stay at stage one. So it seems to me a little generous.
I read it as the opposite.
Opposite?
Yeah, I thought it was the opposite. I think it's easier to make an assessment over the near term than it is over the long term. So I think this actually forces a more rigorous analysis.
So if I can maybe explain how I understood it. In terms of if it's near term, most investment grades would be good, because hopefully within the near term they can pay it. When it becomes longer term, that's where we distinguish the top bit with the bottom off, and there's a bit of uncertainty. So I think with the near term, it's just, one, you can better foresee in the near term, so you can better assess it. But secondly, you're also quite comfortable that the entity is in a very strong position in the near term to meet its obligation. Beyond that is where judgments come in, where it will be higher or lower.
Well, in the case of this three, if there is some adverse change in economic and business conditions, everything will be affected regarding in the near term, in the long term. So if your good analysis of the external agencies, they are using the same terminology, but they just differentiating their 1A and their triple B using this terminology. But in other cases, they are not using any term for their good quality investment.
Yes, because the way that I understand they would see it is that changes in business or economic conditions in the near term would not affect their ability to pay. So they all on that same level, it's just beyond that. Where if it already affects your ability in the nearer term, you would fall within the speculative non-investment grade.
Okay, Pat. Gil, I like everything in 57. I like where you're going with this, with one exception, and it ties into Jan's comments, which I think are very insightful, and that is when a credit moves to this low investment grade or non-investment grade status, and seconding Martin's observations, that I do think it's important to provide some kind of, you know, broad parameters for people to apply this. I can't think of anybody in the marketplace who doesn't view that as a major event. And so this kind of like the other decision on rebuttable presumption, a major negative event, I should emphasize. This says that, clarify that low credit risk in 57C is not meant to be a bright line trigger. Now, I understand we're not writing quote-unquote rules, but I would leave that out. Because I actually think when you do move out of this low credit risk status, it is strong evidence, you know, that you should be moving to lifetime. Now, going from Baa3 to Ba1 may only be a small increase in your lifetime measurement, but still you're in lifetime, you know. And so I think to give them again the safe harbor is the way I look at it, is going to lead to too little, too late. These are two critical aspects of this model, the 30-day rebuttable presumption and this one.
But Pat, doesn't C just say you've got to do an assessment?
It's not safe harbor from assessment.
No,
it's
so you
from having to move to lifetime.
Yeah, and I just think it's going to be counterproductive.
You think you should automatically move to lifetime?
Yeah, because when I look at paragraph B20 in the ED, and I look at what are the leading indicators or some of the indicators I should say that we should be looking at, the first ones that we identify there are credit spread, credit default swap prices, other market information. Well, I got to tell you, I don't know of a company that goes from investment grade to below investment grade that doesn't see those spreads balloon. So you have contradictory evidence now. On the one hand, you're seeing information that's pushing you into lifetime, and then on the other hand, we're saying, oh, it's not automatic. And I just think that we should be basically just telling them, you need to evaluate, but don't view this as a bright line. Strike that language, is what I'm saying.
I understand where your view is coming from. I think it's emphasizing again what this low credit risk exemption does. And all it is doing is exempting you from assessing significant deterioration. So when you pass the bright line, understand your view, you think significant increase in credit risk has happened. We're just forcing someone else to assess that. Maybe 90% of the time they'll conclude the same as you. But I think that's all that
against exemption does. These words as a fallback to saying, you know, it's not a fait accompli. You know, I don't.
Well, it may not.
You can clarify that. Just not in itself.
A fait accompli. Amara.
Thanks, Jim. I'm in general alignment with staff
recommendation. I just want to clarify some aspects that are here. Paragraph 53, that I very much agree with. You say that we believe that the intention with the reference to investment grade did not imply that only those instruments that are externally rated by credit rating agents would qualify to low credit risk exception. So I think this is extremely positive because, first, not all companies are rated. Rating is a process of a service provided by rating agencies, so not everyone is willing to pay for that. Second paragraph, you say that we believe that instruments that are not externally rated may still qualify for the low credit risk exemption. It was only intended to provide an indication of the level of the credit risk that the IFC intended. So I think this paragraph reflects exactly my thinking. However, when I get to paragraph 55, I'm troubled with what you say. Because we start 55 saying, we believe the intention of low credit risk notion was to be a safe harbor for globally accepted high quality instruments. So this contradicts actually what is paragraph 53. Because in paragraph 53, we acknowledge that not all companies are rated, and we acknowledge that that was not the intention of the board. So I have, you continue, use. Furthermore, we are of the view that if the assessment was to be done using national scale rate, the objective of the same may not be achieved. So I do understand the objective of achieving global comparability, and I don't think this is going to work, considering what you stressed in paragraph 63. I'll get to that. I do believe what is written in paragraph 53 should be reflected in the final in the final standard. I had discussion with the staff during small group and afterwards. I don't know if the words proposed by Daryl or the idea I would say proposed by Daryl will get me there. When he was talking, I would read the other way around instead of starting with the globally accepted or the reference to the global rate and then scale down to the national rate or internal rate. I would start differently and having the global rate maybe as an indication or second aspect to be considered, because the model is an entity specific model. The model is a risk management model, principles-based. So I think we have put a lot of emphasis in the external credit rate with this wording right now, with external credit rating, and mostly in the global rating. And so I do, again, agree with paragraph 53 very much, and I expect the idea exposed by Daryl will bring us to what I believe is right in paragraph 53.
But there is a contradiction, isn't there? Because 53 says you don't have to be rated at all.
Exactly.
And then you go on and say, but if you rate it, it has to be globally rated.
Well, I think maybe the terminology in 55 could have been better if it said we believe the intention of the law was a safe harbor for the globally accepted definition of high quality.
That level of probability is fault for me. Yep. That's what we mean. Yeah, well, our wording's not.
Let's hope the wording will get us there.
But can I just push back a little bit on that? Because 53, as Amaro said, says you don't have to be rated at all.
Yeah, and most of the time there are no ratings.
But it should be that sort of quality of credit risk, though.
Yes.
That's what we're trying to do.
But you could be only nationally rated or not rated at all. And
I think
as long as you accept the credit risk, it's that
globally accepted definition of high quality. Yeah. And I think what I've been going to say about this is to agree with what Martin said, was that it's critically important here that we give people some type of external thing to aim at. Not an external rating, but an externally acceptable definition of what low risk is.
Not even acceptable, and I think that's understood.
That's what we're trying to get at. We're trying to get to that globally understood. And I think paragraph 48 was quite important in that, and actually listing the individual items that make up those definitions. I wasn't sure if this was actually going to make it into the standard exactly like this. But I think it provides the ability to understand what the
what the rating agencies are aiming at when they use the terminology investment grade. It allows people who don't actually have external ratings to still get to those external ratings because you've got the right words there. You've got words that are understood at a global level. So I think that that's important in the context there. I won't comment on the accounting policy yet. I'll come back to that later.
I'm sorry, I might be a bit dumb, but 55 to me, 53 says you can work out what's low credit risk for yourself. 55 then says, well, the intention is that we have globally accepted high quality instruments.
No. The equivalent of that policy of credit risk. We haven't worded it well.
The wording I think the wording in 55 is slightly wrong. It needs to say the globally accepted definition of low risk. The problem and the point I was making earlier is that national scales have a different definition.
I understood that. And so if it's not low credit risk under a national rate, you know, if it's got a national rating but it's not low credit risk, then it's not in. I understand that. And that sort of 53 covers that. The 55 did seem to contradict.
So there was one other point I wanted to make, which is just to respond to Pat, which I think we're doing quite a lot today. I think one of the concerns I have with Pat's automatic trigger, and I worry about any automatic trigger anywhere, is that 99% of the time it's going to be right. And that's fine. It's the 1% of the time when it's wrong that kind of starts to discredit the whole process. The bank that I used to work for had a credit rating scale that had 100 points on it. And that meant for each of the points on a Moody's scale, it had 10 or 12 points on it. Now that means you could move, theoretically you could advance a loan to somebody who was in the bottom 12th of a rating that was investment grade, and it moved 1/100th was enough to take it from what we perceive as low risk to the next level. Now that's certainly enough to open your eyes and to have a look, but I don't think that's enough to trigger what we think is a significant deterioration in risk. I think once you put in a rule, you start to discredit the whole process. So I would be very reluctant.
But that's not what we're talking about. And that's not the information that we get into the marketplace. What? That's the problem with your analogy.
The problem is, no, remember what we're saying is that I must define low risk.
I know, but the way we're defining it is by reference to market-based definitions, okay? So I agree with you in your example, if it went 1/100th, no, you're right. The problem is we're talking about when something goes from Baa3 to Ba1. That's what we'll get into the marketplace.
But when it goes from Baa, whatever.
Yeah. Or triple B.
It may only have moved a very, very small amount.
I don't disagree, but the market doesn't perceive it that way. And credit spreads widen.
Are you saying then that you would only apply that rule in those circumstances where it is externally rated and that external rating?
No. I'm just suggesting to drop paragraph C, and as a result, when you have something that moves out of low, or you may have something that moves out of low credit risk as a result of the kinds of indicators we specify in B20.
I guess my concern is that it may move out of low credit risk on my own rating scale.
Correct.
And people have interpreted that to mean even if it is that 1/100th of a move. When it moves from the one to the other.
And you wouldn't be prevented from making that judgment by removing this, okay? But by having this here, I actually think this ends up potentially providing a backstop for not adjusting rating.
I think we're good enough of the debate. Gary?
Credit allowance, it should be adjusted. Just a quick one, actually. I support the discussion on credit risk is indicative of the thought process as opposed to the procedures, but to the extent we're going to use rating agencies and credit rating in the document, I would think someplace in the background, doesn't have to be in there, we should probably make an observation that often companies have several credit ratings. You know, you got your commercial paper one, your senior debt, compare company subsidiaries, perhaps a line of credit, and you just want to make the point that if you're looking to that, you should, and the company's got multiple rating agencies, look to one that's most aligned with, you know, the instruments that you're evaluating the credit risk. You could have a very solid and very rich company in the short term, but its industry is in a long-term decline. You know, they won't be there in 20 years, but you'll know they'll be there in 2 years. So you will get their ratings.
Okay. Mary?
I had some hesitation about the low credit risk exemption, but I think on balance I support the recommendation to retain it. I think it's very important that we make the clarifications that's come out of the discussion about it's your own definition of low credit risk, but what you use cannot be less than what a globally recognized rating of low credit risk is. I disagree with Pat Finnegan's idea that when you fall below the equivalent of globally recognized investment grade, it should automatically move to stage two. I had been very much of that view, kind of saying it quantitatively it might have been a small tick downwards, but qualitatively it's a major step to go from investment grade to non-investment grade. And think about it further, I realized that I think at least some of the, I hadn't focused on the change in spreads, but some of the impact is the difference in liquidity because of entities that are required to hold only investment grade securities, so that when you move from investment grade to non-investment grade, it's a big difference because there's a group that may hold you now that can't hold you. So there's a liquidity cost, but that's going back to an earlier discussion. That is a change in fair value, kind of the way you talk about a change in loss given default. It's not a change in, it's not automatically a significant change in credit. So I agree, but I think it would be worth noting in the basis for conclusion that there can be very significant consequences of moving from investment grade to non-investment grade, but they may relate more to changes in fair value in part because of liquidity. And since we are focusing on this for a matter of saying, has there been significant credit deterioration, that it's not an automatic transfer to category two.
I'd be happy if you just struck the first sentence of C and you kept the second sentence and be consistent with what Mary just said.
No, it wouldn't be. I don't think that's what you said before. Very good.
Let's talk against to mention at all the so-called globally accepted.
Okay, thank you.
Because, you know, it is to some extent politically sensitive, and also emotionally people will not feel acceptable.
Okay. Can you feel that we've had a good debate on this?
Well, a long one anyway.
So do we go to the question?
I think let's first discuss based on the discussion, what there is, then what you want to do with it, and then I'll ask for the vote for the package. So having clarified then low credit risk to the extent that we try to, the question is whether the board wants to keep the proposals in the exposure draft, namely requires that the exemption be applied, or respondents had said that mixed views on this, and both had a cost-benefit analysis concern. So based on that, the staff has three alternatives. The first being keep the current proposals to require that the exemption be applied. Second, to remove the exemption. And thirdly, our recommendation is to allow the accounting policy choice. One of our arguments is that we believe, similar to the arguments in the exposure draft, the difference between applying the exemption and not applying the exemption would be minimal. But for that, I open questions on the nature of the exemption.
Yeah.
It seems to me a bit odd to say that an exemption is required to be applied. It's not an exemption by nature. You have a rule, and you can, or in other circumstances, not apply the rule. That's fine. But then to say it's an exception, it's not an exemption. It's a different regime. You can't speak about exemption, but exception. This being said, I don't see why we would mandate it. I mean, some companies may have a different system, they might want to take a different approach and consider put more weight on any change in rating, including within that category. Why for them not to apply it or for them to apply it? Now, if we say that, it means it has to be either or. Either you apply it or you don't. On what basis? Is it purely an accounting policy choice, or is it something else that could cause this choice? I mean, is it free choice, or is there some reason for choosing A or B? As it is presented, you seem to make it a total discrete choice, a pure option. Have you considered any other reasons for applying or not applying this exemption?
Okay, so my thought was maybe that it was more free choice, because what's driven them is the fact that the ones that feel it's going to create an operational burden is not going to do it. The ones that feel it is providing relief is going to select it. So they choose it based on what they internally feel these systems can cope.
If you can link this notion of option, accounting for its choice, with this underlying analysis, it's fine with me. What I don't like is a system which clearly says choose a policy without any consideration of the reasons for choosing the policy.
Well, I have a lot of sympathy with what Martin was saying about the fact that the original reason behind the expedient was actually a message in itself. We were saying that movements within there are probably not enough to be significant. At the same time, I do know that there are banks out there that do track all of their exposures. I also know, as I mentioned earlier when I was having a discussion with Pat, was the fact that you have banks with many, many ratings, much more than what a normal rating, and some of those rating groups will straddle the low risk to medium risk. And for those banks, it might actually be quite useful to be able to track the before and the after picture, so that they know whether it's moved enough to actually justify. So I saw this as an expedient. I think we've already communicated the message that we see that top as being low enough, not necessarily to trigger. And I think if people want to track, I think they should be allowed to track. I don't see us needing to enforce the expedient, if you like. So I would support the accounting policy choice.
But do you call that an accounting policy choice? I mean, to me, we're just saying you've got to track significant deterioration. But by the way, if you've got these high-grade investments, you can do a shortcut for it. But does that, I mean, you're doing the same thing at the end. You're trying to track significant deterioration.
In some ways, what we're saying is that if you have a very high-end thing and it moves by a... and maybe that is a good question. Maybe that's a question worth asking. If I had something that starts at AAA and it moves within investment grade quite far, does our current standards say, well, that's not significant, so you don't transfer?
Yes.
And to me, if I think it is significant deterioration, I think I should be able to actually.
But
I believe
that was the question I raised early.
But the principle is you're trying to work out significant deterioration or not, isn't it? And as I said a minute ago, this is just a shortcut way of saying we're willing to concede in these circumstances. You don't have to go any further to work it out. But if you do want to go further, I don't see why you should be discredited.
But that means you're
not sure
that means
an accounting policy.
That means you're supporting a policy, though, because our...
No, it doesn't have to be.
The current guidance in the standards says that in that circumstance, you can't actually move it to stage two.
Yeah.
Stephen.
You said that the difference between applying and not applying is minimal. And I thought that was the reason why we did this in the first place, that if you're high quality, it's likely that deterioration is not going to be significant, or it's likely that any losses that you measure would be minimal anyway. So why bother going through all this assessment just to prove that fact? I don't see how you can have an accounting policy choice which has minimal effect. It seems like a bit of a contradiction. And Darrell used the word practical expedient, and that's what I would make it. It would be that you are permitted not to go through the assessment if something is high quality. But if your systems are set up such in a way that you want to assess everything, well, then that's fine. It would be silly to ban somebody from doing it. It's just that we would expect that the practical effect of that on the high quality instruments wouldn't mean material in the context of the entity as a whole.
That's exactly what I meant, just much better
too. So would you, for example, suggest something like you may assume that there hasn't been a significant increase in credit risk if it's low credit risk at the reporting date?
Yeah.
I'm totally with you.
Okay, so on that theme, so almost more or less things that Stephen...
Yeah, they agree.
Okay. So, based on that thing,
we have the club.
Yeah. would the board then be comfortable to introduce them as a practical expedient, which just means we have to draft it as one?
No, I wouldn't even call it anything as fancy as that. I'd just word it as you may assume that there's no significant deterioration in credit risk if it's low credit risk at the reporting date.
Yes? Okay, vote in favour of it?
Yes.
But Sue, just to come back to the question I teed up at the very beginning and Daryl raised again, are you permitted to assume there's been significant increase in credit risk?
Yes. You may assume, but you can decide otherwise.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So that was 12.
Then having that, then the question becomes, in if you apply that for low credit risk, then do you agree with the clarifications that we listed for what it means with low credit risk?
Okay. Those in favour?
Sorry, this is the first question.
That's the first question, yeah.
Well, but we agree with all the comments about the global taking the committee.
Yes.
Taking this into consideration, blah, blah, blah.
I support with that one.
If we agree not with the global rating, but with the globally accepted
definition,
blah, blah, blah.
So that's the way we're objecting to reference to rating agencies.
Yes, to global ratings, right?
But I also don't feel it is necessary here. Please. This is accounting standard.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't think anybody's going to understand what quality we mean unless we use some kind of...
How do we provide that?
I don't think it's necessary.
No, I don't want to have the debate on this again. We're having
don't think it's necessary, you know.
No, I think this is important.
No, for example, we discuss insurance. We discuss about, you know, the actual. Should we mention, you know, insurance standards said, you know, anything related to actual assessment, we should have a so-called accepted international standard or definition.
Would it be better if it wasn't in the standard itself? So, guidance or...
I don't think it's necessary, you know.
I just don't think that we're going to clearly articulate what we mean by low credit risk unless we, at a minimum, use it as an example. Yeah. And even then, that would make me a bit nervous.
And have all the tougher
budget. But you can put the example in the base for conclusion. I think... But even the reference to the external credit rating agency, I think it's not aligned with the principle. And we can, I was expecting with Dara's idea that we could achieve the same objective as quality or qualitative characteristics of low credit rating without making reference to external rating agencies.
I really am doubtful about that. Given the feedback we had on the ED, even where we used the word investment grade, because we didn't say whether it was global or national, we were getting loads of questions. So if we don't at least have that, and I really think we're going to really struggle to communicate what we mean to Martin's point about a clear anchor. I know it's sort of...
As long as you're brief, Mary, I don't want to be longer.
I think we absolutely, positively have to say affirmatively, do not need to have external credit rating.
Yes.
Okay. Absolutely, positively, clearly, we are not requiring that. We use your own definition of low credit, but that has to achieve something that is the equivalent of what is used externally as credit. So we aren't saying...
No, but I think we agreed that before. Could I have a vote on who finds that acceptable?
So the meaning is that if you have that, you don't have to provide, right?
Yeah.
I do my own assessment, my national gap. My national credit assessment, and I'm free. I think that's wrong.
Subject to your clarification, that it's your assessment of the low credit risk, and for example...
But I'm happy that you're happy.
Yeah. Let's move on. What are we... Is that it? Okay, welcome back. And... just a general warning, we'll work through till we're finished. Those of you who've got commitments this evening, you might be going to.
I don't even leave when we're done.
I support it.
We're going to have to come early tonight. So.
Okay. It is leading.
Paper 5C, measurement of expected credit loss. So the exposure draft proposed that implying the general model, an entity recognizes lifetime expected credit losses on instruments whose credit risk significantly increased, and secondly, the 12-month expected credit losses for all other instruments. In measuring expected credit losses, the exposure draft proposed that the measurement reflects an unbiased probability-weighted amount of expected credit losses, and secondly, time value of money. This paper discusses the feedback we received and the potential clarifications in measuring the expected credit losses. We will be discussing three aspects. First, the applicable discount rate, then the use of reasonable and supportable forecasts and use of regulatory models, and lastly, the measurement of the 12-month expected credit loss. The paper does not discuss the measurement of expected credit losses for loan commitments and financial guarantees. Neither does it discuss it, the discount rate for purchase and originated credit impaired instruments. Those we will be discussing at a future meeting. As we walk through, this was the previous paper, I will introduce a particular section and stop for discussion before continuing. So the first issue is the applicable discount rate. As mentioned earlier, the measurement of expected credit losses proposed that it reflects the time value of money. The board has always reviewed that discounting is an integral part of the amortized cost measurement, and accordingly, we do not intend to discuss that aspect again. Rather, we want to focus on the applicable discount rate for discounting expected shortfalls in contractual cash flow. In the exposure draft, the board proposed to permit for instruments in stage 1 and 2 the use of a reasonable rate between and including the risk-free rate and the effective interest rate. This was consistent with the proposals in the 2011 supplementary document, which was supported by the majority of the respondents. The board has consistently said that the effective interest rate is the conceptually correct answer. However, to address the operability concerns with tracking the effective interest rate, which was raised in the 2009 proposal, the board believes that from a cost-benefit analysis, permitting a range of discount rates would make the model more operable. The exposure draft allows the range of discount rates therefore to be used. However, we did not ask a question on this again. A number of respondents, however, did comment on this proposal, the majority of which did not support it. We would like to point out that because the board did not ask a question, the views of those that previously did support these proposals might not be reflected. Respondents that supported the proposals argue that applying the effective interest rate, even though conceptually sound, is more complex, particularly for open portfolios, info financial instruments for which there have not been individually identified impairment allowances. Those that oppose the proposal argue that the effective interest rate is the conceptual answer and is consistent with other proposals in the ED, for example, instruments in stage 3. Discounting at a risk-free rate is not appropriate, as all instruments would have some level of credit risk. Some also said the range was too flexible, and most importantly, a lot of them noted that the difference between discounting within this range could be material, particularly for high interest rate environments. The rate to recognize for interest revenue would also then not be aligned to the rate that we use to discount expected credit losses. Currently, the proposals of the ISB on discounting are not aligned to the most recent decisions of the FASB, which is discussed in paragraphs 28 to 30. We recommend carrying forward the discount rate proposed in the exposure draft, i.e. to permit a range of discount rates. However, we do recommend introducing some guidance as to what is meant with a reasonable rate. We discuss these in paragraphs 38 to 42. As an alternative, the board could require the use of effective interest rate or an approximation thereof, and additionally allow the use of a risk-free rate when impracticable to determine the effective interest rate. With that, I open the discussions for the applicable discount.
Okay. Any comments?
So the paragraph 42 or paragraph 50 is what I'm looking at in your recommendation. So you provide additional guidance as to what a reasonable rate is, and it's got to be each of these different elements in A and B. That sounds to me like EIR. So you're giving a range between EIR and EIR.
Some have said that and raised that point. I think what we were trying to achieve is to indicate what kind of things you need to look at. And these would be the elements. Now, the question is maybe that if it's not the EAR and you have another rate, does it at least include some of these elements, or do you disregard all of them?
In other words,
or are they an equal extent included?
So in other words, is it an approximation of EIR? So why not just say that?
Well, it does say it may, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you but B is...
Yeah, you just stop after A and...
Or do you mean that the approximation should consider the things that are in B?
No. That wasn't the way I intended it when we drafted that. It was more...
Well, I'm saying that if you look at the factors in B, it seems to me that you get an approximation of EIR.
I tend to agree with you. So what are you saying? Are you suggesting then that it should say a rate that approximates EIR, and when you're approximating EIR, consider the things that are listed in B?
I thought you were almost saying more than that, because 49 says give a range. 50 says, but actually nothing in the range is going to qualify except the IR.
Yeah.
That wasn't the intention.
But I mean, that's almost what I think that's what you were saying.
That's the point
I'm
making.
It almost seems like the answer is 49 and then 50 becomes a bit redundant.
Well, I'm not sure I'd like the answer of 49. That's my problem.
So that gives you a twist. Are you saying, Gil, is that it's either the risk-free rate, the EIR, or an approximation of the EIR? The actual EIR or an approximation of the EIR?
I think that would be like alternative meeting. So if we consider, so in the paper we discussed the broad range. So let's take the example of it's between 2 and 20%. So assume an entity decides that the applicable discount rate is 10%. Okay? There was a question on, well, if we think, is that a reasonable rate or is it not? And I think what we were trying to do is introduce guidance for, okay, so what would be a reasonable rate? Maybe the 10% is, but have you at least considered these factors, and do you feel you're adequately compensated or dressed in using the 10%?
But could risk-free ever be a reasonable rate?
I think even the board said it doesn't really believe that.
So then why mention a range between risk-free and EIR if risk-free could never actually qualify as a reasonable rate?
But isn't the reasonable rate between? That's what I'm getting confused by. Paragraph 49 says use any reasonable rate between the risk-free rate and the EIR.
And including.
Yeah. And that is what is in the exposure draft at the moment. I mean, we've said that they can use a risk-free rate. And if you want to say, you know, any reasonable rate between risk-free and EIR, it sort of implies that then risk-free would be reasonable.
Yeah.
No, risk-free is not reasonable. Not reasonable. Because what you are doing, you're defining factors that could be in reasonable rate, and you include, then in one of the factors is a risk-free, but you're adding others, and therefore it could not be in the range.
That wasn't how I read it, though, because I thought that risk-free is something everybody understands. EIR is something everybody understands. But why should you just be able to make up any old number in between the two?
But in
I thought the reasonable only referred to the bits in between. Yeah.
But in 50B you are saying a rate that reflects the reasonable is, and it should be the reasonable rate in that range. But reasonable rate, you say, that reflects the following factors. And that all the factors include the risk-free rate. But all the others. So that means that the risk-free rate is not a reasonable.
I don't think that's what they meant, though. I think you meant the risk-free rate, the proper EIR, or something on the range in between, as long as it's reasonable. Yeah.
And then we give.
But then it was not defined.
So it seems that there's two interpretations.
Well, we're getting out of hand here.
Well, I think that's what was meant. The wording I can see might be confusing, but I think that was what alternative one means.
I think the paper 49. The ones that the ED give people impression, you know, you can use a rate, start with the risk-free rate, up to effective interest rate. Yeah, but 50 give me an impression, you know, risk-free rate capital is not. You must choose a one which is called a reasonable rate, which must have the following factors.
Let's re-articulate. So I think what we want to discuss is whether you want to make a change so that the choice is you can use the risk-free rate, you can use the proper, if I can use that term, EIR, or you can use something between those two as long as it's reasonable. So that's what that's what it means.
Why does the rate in between have to be reasonable? Because we agree that you can use the risk-free rate and it isn't reasonable.
Well, we could remove the word reasonable. We had the word reasonable in the ED and people said, well, what does it mean? On what basis?
Well, I think that's because they recognise that risk-free isn't reasonable.
No. It was just, is it a free choice on the spectrum or not?
I think to me, the reading of reasonable in the exposure talk was about saying that you need to have a reasonable basis for choosing a rate.
Exactly.
You can't simply say, well, I've got this range, let me pick 4% today and 5% tomorrow and 3% the next day because it's in the range. I had to have a reasonable basis for coming to that. I don't think that's what paragraph 50 is suggesting. So I think paragraph 50, 49 says the same as the ED, and then 50 says actually different to the ED. Okay. I think that's the problem that we're sort of picking up here.
Yes, and we're suggesting if we want to keep the word reasonable, did we want to put some boundaries on what reasonable meant? And there's one suggestion of how that boundary could be created.
John Wood.
Thank you. Based on the paragraph 20 and P.
20?
20 P.
Okay.
Both ecology preparers did not agree with our proposal. But we are still recommending alternative one.
Yes, but I think this ties into what I mentioned earlier. So for those comments that we received, the majority did not agree. But we have never asked the question during the exposure drop. So the issue is that those that previously, when we did ask the question, presented both the support and the opposition, when we removed the question, we got still the ones that were not happy with it. But it's that where the majority did not agree, it's the majority of the responses that we received, which was definitely not the majority of all the comments.
Yes. And you made a quite good summary of the reasons why they do not agree with our proposal in paragraph 23. There are quite varied reasons why they don't like our current proposal. So maybe we might have an alternative three, you know. Maybe by default methods we apply EIR. But otherwise if it's impractical, then you can use any reasonable rate between these two ranges except excluding EIR.
But if you don't know EIR, how can you don't know what is EIR? How can you be in it? Yes.
Yeah, I understand that there is some kind of very careful wording, but I'm saying by default apply EIR. If you do not know EIR, then excluding EIR the range between the EIR and RF.
Okay, so just to rephrase to make sure. So your recommendation would be that we say as the number one thing, use the EIR.
Yes.
But if impracticable to determine that, then we submit the rank.
That's what you're suggesting.
Yes.
Okay. Mary.
Appreciate staff comments on this. Looking at the feedback section, which is paragraph 26-27, if the feedback, not just from people expressing views the last time we actively consulted, but also from the work that we've done with entities that spent the time doing the field work, was that it's important to have some flexibility. And to me, that ties back to my understanding of the feedback on the original consultation that said trying to track everything on a loan-by-loan basis, which EIR requires, I think, for you to do it on a loan-by-loan basis. Is that correct?
Subject to materiality.
Yeah, subject to materiality. That we just can't, if they could do that, then we could probably go back to the original proposal. So I think we do have to give some kind of relief from you must use the EIR for each loan because you have to do expected credit, expected loss whether you're in stage one, stage two, or stage three. So, you know, if we've heard that we just can't do EIR on a loan by loan basis, then I think it's about how we express what relief we grant. And I can see when you look in the fieldwork section, people are talking about what other rates they use, for example, implicit in their existing credit risk management system, weighted average cost of capital, et cetera. So I support the idea of saying if you can't do EIR as the objective, we understand there are practical difficulties with doing EIR on an instrument by instrument basis. Consider how you can approximate that and, putting some kind of boundaries around it. I am troubled by the implication that it's anything that's between here and there, especially when the bottom of that is something that seems to me, the risk-free rate is something that seems too low a discount rate and therefore would increase the amount of cash that would reduce the amount of the loss. So I'm supportive of keeping some flexibility. But I think we tighten what we do.
It would actually increase the allowance because you're discounting the shortfalls and cash flows.
So the allowance would just be
bigger.
Measuring the loss, not the cash flow.
We don't want cookie jars either.
But just to be clear, that we're all understanding.
Right, and I've done this before. You've corrected me before, and I just can't get it in my brain.
Martin.
I'm really with alternatives. I'm the staff proposal, but really clarifying that it should be really the range. And I'm really not so concerned because exactly the reason, because when the risk-free rate is will increase the loan loss provision or the impairment provision, and I'm not so concerned that there is a lot of misuse in this regard. And if it is really, we got the feedback that people don't have this EIR, and why not really allowing them? We have discussed already and thought that it's appropriate. If it would go in a different direction, that people can really have really their buildings, their impairment provision, and using that range, and they can really underestimate that, and I would say, okay, that may be the problem, but goes in the direction where I'm really not concerned that people not using an approximation of the ERR. And therefore we should say, okay, it could be the ERR, anything between the ERR and the free rate, and many people will use the, I think, approximation of the ERR. That is what I think.
I'm concerned about it being too high as well as being too low. I mean, theoretically, you could have an allowance that's bigger than the carrying value of the loan if you risk it. I agree we need a simplification because for open portfolios, simply saying EIR is too difficult. And although we have it in IS 39, there's already problems there. And of course, we're only applying it to a more limited subset of loans than we would do under this proposal. But the solution of anything in the range was devised for the supplementary document, and that had an even bigger. Well, it was every single loan was then measured on a lifetime loss basis. So I don't have a magic answer for this, but I'm just still concerned about just this range. So if you can find some wording to get EIR, an approximation to EIR. I don't like the idea of an impracticability exemption because I think that's such a high hurdle. I don't think that works. If you're going to do some sort of thing like that, it has to be undue cost or effort, I think, to deal with it. But I haven't got the wording, but I just feel we could improve where we are.
So you're saying it could be the risk-free rate, the EIR, or something reasonable between?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to charge the risk-free rate?
I would like an objective of EIR, an allowance to have an approximation to EIR, but if there's cost-benefit limitations, another reasonable rate.
Not as far as the risk-free rate?
No.
I'm just trying to work out what your range is. For the case where it's undue cost.
Yeah, I don't know what I would do in that situation, but I just like to have an objective of EIR rather than anything between.
Philippe.
I'm exactly on the same line as Stephen. I think you cannot say that a rate has to be chosen between risk-free and EIR if by hypothesis you don't know what is your EIR. It doesn't just help my logic. If you don't know, you cannot be within that range. Now,
The objective should be EIR, yes. Cost benefit, difficult to track it on a loan by loan basis, agree. So maybe an approximation is okay. A reasonable rate that tries to approximate EIR on an individual basis is fine. How do you do it? We have guidance here. Little b, should reflect time value of money, compensation for credit losses, maybe on an average basis, because you don't do it case by case. Compensation for risk, you apply risk margin, profit margin, standard profit margin, etc. So, trying to do an average type of EIR on a portfolio basis, based on this guidance, as an approximation to doing a loan by loan EIR. Fine, I think this should be okay.
Amara.
Just would like to reinforce the importance of the suggestion made by Stephen. In particular, considering the feedback we received from and as described in paragraph 23, and particularly letter C, and with the example of high interest rate environments and high credit risk products. So there's particular region that I'm quite familiar with, that the difference between the risk-free rate and the actual rate charged in the law can reach 1,000 basis points. So this is not really a small difference. So I guess the suggestion made by Stephen is very important.
Okay. Yeah.
I've got a view very similar to Martin's, that I felt that given the feedback we got that led us to the decision we made in the supplementary document, it seemed like we needed to provide some kind of range. I've got a heck of a fear for any time we come along and say EIR, but if it's too hard to calculate something else, because how do you define what too hard to calculate is? So I'd been very comfortable with the range, and I was very comfortable with the range on another basis, which is the one that Mary touched on, that you push towards the right rate by the fact that anything else overstates your provision, so it understates your profitability, understates your capital, does all the bad things that you like. So you push towards using the EIR, which is the highest rate available in the range we give. What I was a little bit concerned about is whether you could chop and change with rates, move into one rate, change the rate, which is your cookie jar concern. And so I wondered whether what we meant by reasonable was, once you've got something, stick with that something. Now, whether we want to put a guideline in here that says, if you have EIR, use EIR. So in other words, don't ignore it if you've got it. But otherwise, you can use something within the range, but whatever you use within the range is something you should consistently use over time. And reasonable is, there must be a basis on which you've calculated the number, and it should be consistently used over a period of time. That seems to me it would continue to encourage people to use the highest rate, which is the EIR rate. It would take away the need to have the argument about, or the auditors about, what costs and benefits really are in the circumstance, which always feels to me like an impossible place to go down. And it would make sure there was consistency, so you avoid the cookie jar accounting approach.
So Gerald, the consistency in terms of methodology rather than a particular rate.
Yes.
Any other comments?
I have a question. The unit of account for this, this is what gives me great pause. Someone said you have to do it at the individual instrument level. I'm not sure that's absolutely correct. When you're talking about open portfolios and you're managing thousands of loans accumulating into, you know, billions of dollars, I'm not so sure that's the most expedient way to deal with this. So I guess the question is what actually are we saying about how you would go about calculating this? If we're going to provide an objective and then somewhat soften that objective to say, well, when you can't actually calculate the EIR, you're permitted to do the following. Question in my mind is, at what level a unit of account? Is it by portfolio? Because the EIR you calculate for credit cards is going to be different from mortgages, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, frankly, it starts to get into some of the issues and debates we're having in the insurance project. It's not dissimilar in a way. So this whole determination of the discount rate issue, I think, is probably one of the most sensitive
assumptions that are generally made in coming up with the allowance. We've been spending an awful lot of time focusing on judgments, you know, about, you know, when you're going from stage one to stage two and the information using, et cetera, et cetera. And you're right, that's all very important. But frankly, this is going to probably drive the number as much as any of those calculations, or I should say judgments. So I think we can't be kind of too high up here and indefinite and vague about how this is being done. I think it has to be more specific guidance on this.
But on the EIR point, I don't think we need to start putting new guidance on how to calculate EIR, because that's already in our literature and people haven't.
Well, then can you tell me then how you would say this would be applied? What's the unit of account? What level?
Well, I think in theory, in our literature, EIR is calculated on an instrument-by-instrument basis, but we know that in practice that people look at things on a portfolio basis and do approximations using materiality.
Right. Exactly.
So I can't see that it would be any different for this.
So don't we need to put that language then into the document?
I don't think so.
Why not?
Well, there hasn't been a need to do it so far, so why would we do it just for impairment when EIR is already used to calculate interest revenue all the time?
Well, I guess I'm getting the sense that perhaps there is a need, particularly if we're going to start talking about the use of ranges. You know, that in my mind leads me to
thinking. We're not using the EIR.
I'm sorry?
That's only going to apply when we're not using the EIR, so that's not the actual definition of
but
EIR.
Isn't that going to be most of the time, though? In other words, most people are going to say they can't calculate the EIR.
But Sue's point is you don't change the definition of EIR.
I'm asking unit of account. I'm talking about all these other practical expedients that we're talking about here. I just think there needs to be a little bit more.
Yeah, we should allow an approximation of EIR. I think yeah. Your point is covered. Philip has said.
Harry.
Well, I'm just thinking that some of what Patrick was saying is when we start talking about why we'll allow some simplification and, you know, we still have the objective of EIR, maybe our first focus should be pointing out that the simplification is the unit of account, that rather than the subjective of EIR, meaning what you're trying to approximate is calculating on an instrument-by-instrument basis, that if what you're trying to do is calculate an approximation of EIR on a portfolio basis, that gets you to that, what is that reasonable number? Just before we start talking about moving away from it or using weighted average cost of capital or something that's in your credit risk system, if you point out that a simplification is moving from individual instrument to group.
I mean, all this is done, all this discussion in the paper is talked about in the context of an individual contract or loan, and the reality is that's not the way it's going to be done. So it seems to be not very useful for the preparer to apply that guidance. It leaves an awful lot of questions and discretion about how I go about doing it.
Well, I think it's going to be the case. We've had quite a few suggestions. I wonder if, Daryl, you could just summarize briefly.
It
kind of summed up a few of them, I think.
So effectively what I would the range I would keep, because I think we've heard very clearly that the range is necessary. I think we should be saying that if you have EIR, you should use EIR. In other words, that's what we're trying to actually achieve with it.
What does it mean to have EIR? That's the question. What does it mean to have EIR?
If you have an internal EIR number, that's what
everybody has an EIR number, but maybe not in the right system.
It goes to the domain.
Sorry?
A virtual domain.
Able to determine. Now we're probably starting to stretch, but let's run with it. So my view was that if you have EIR, in other words, part of the calculation, part of the process, you do it. And remember, you have an EIR that you're using for your stage three. That's at an individual level, because by then you've identified the individual loan. So do you have something in stage two and stage one that is consistent with the EIR you're using in stage three? If so, using a consistent rate through the process makes sense to me.
So I would say that if you've got that, you should target that. And then I would say reasonable to me means that there must be a calculation basis. So whatever you're using within the range must be based on an underlying calculation basis. There must be a way of proving that's a number, and you must use it consistently from period to period.
So can you use this grid?
Can you use what?
If that is the only other rate you've got, then yes.
The range would include risk-free, I think.
How can it be the only amount you know? You must have a profit margin. You must have a margin for servicing. You have to be able to determine something.
Exactly.
The risk-free is the only thing I know.
The problem for me is really to try to pick what that something else is. So how do I establish? I'm comfortable with the top of the range. Top of the range is the EIR.
Yeah.
How do I give a name to that other point in the range?
As you said, you do a calculation, you try to demonstrate that it makes sense, but how can you come up to the conclusion that risk-free makes sense? Have you never seen a bank lending on a risk-free basis?
I agree.
But he's discussing, for example, loans that maybe after 20 years, they come from level 1 into level 2. Okay. And then you have to calculate a discount rate. And if you want to require them really to have a profit margin and a risk margin all included, you have to track it. What was my risk margin 20 years ago for this portfolio? What was my profit margin? That is the problem. That was the reason why we said, okay, we have to...
And also, if you look at the history, it came from the decoupling decision. So it came from this fact that we're now looking at shortfalls and contractual cash flows on portfolios, and you don't necessarily know which items, which assets or instruments that they're attached to. And so identifying the EIRs that are relevant to the shortfalls and cash flows is difficult to do in an open portfolio. And so that's why we originally had this concession, which we always knew was a big concession.
But are we actually, so just listening to Daryl's recap, are we actually saying, or you can use the risk-free rate, or I don't think so. I think what Daryl was saying is you must use a number that you calculate consistently period to period, but then you must look at the output of that calculation, and if that number is lower than the risk, whatever the risk-free rate is, you can't use that calculation.
Well, I think certainly what I'm saying is that you can't use a rate that is lower than the risk-free, yes.
It isn't saying that I elect to use the risk-free rate, whatever the risk-free rate is, it's just saying...
Why do you've been looking to get in it?
I think you know, combine what Daryl and Martin say is enough. What Martin says is someone wants to choose this rate, and then you actually will suffer because this rate will be the lowest rate, and discounted the present value of the impairment will be highest. And so combine these two, I think it's enough, you know. And
well, I don't think Martin was disagreeing with Daryl. I think
you say the same thing. Else.
That's Stephen, sorry.
Can I just confirm, risk-free, we mean current risk-free?
Yes, yes. So it could be the case that your current risk-free is higher than your old EIR, in theory.
That's another reason why I don't like risk-free.
Especially after 25 years. So 25 years ago, risk-free was 10%. Now it's 2%.
I think it's the opposite. Loans originated today, going forward 10 years, and you might have a very different interest rate environment
in both situations.
So, but then we could go to alternative two and they require an EIR or an approximation of EIR based on your suggestion, or saying then what Steve has said, if it is with undue cost or something like that, then you can use the range and disclose that what you are using. I think that's the only alternative. So we don't say a range from risk-free to EIR, we just say you try to approximate EIR? EIR or an approximation, approximation should be allowed. That is, I think, key.
Yes.
But if both is really with undue cost or effort or something like that, I don't know what the right wording is, then maybe you can use the range and disclose what you have done.
Yeah.
Do the staff get that?
So you've gone through all of these, and you've said, well, you know, undue cost and effort, I have to go through a range. Does that range sort include the risk-free rate?
Yeah, then it includes the risk-free
rate. Where can't be to it?
Because I think no, I don't know the thing.
So maybe just like say back from where we are today in the ED where we have the range, all we'll do is basically on top of that strip out that effective interest rate or approximation thereof, and then otherwise it falls back to the ED basically.
And with this, they clearly give an objective, what people should do. Okay. And that is the difference to alternative A, where we don't give really an objective and so you can use what you
want. It means, for example, if your EIR is likely to be very similar to your risk-free, you might argue that you can go with risk-free because it makes sense in that. But if it's very different, for example, view it with it.
The UK now is very different.
Yeah. Then you wouldn't go.
Yeah.
I don't know under this suggestion that you have to mention a range. I think if the principle is you're trying to approximate the IR and there's cost constraints or whatever, then you go to a reasonable approximation of the IR. Why do you have to say the bottom end of that risk-free?
I'm back to getting nervous about what a reasonable approximation is. How do you actually get to a reasonable approximation? Does that not mean you have to get
Don't you have objective evidence of premiums, discounts, transaction costs, fees? I mean, that's all in the system. That's part of your pricing.
Gail, you defined reasonable as a methodology that you use consistently.
Because it is a reasonable approximation of EIR. So certainly a reasonable approximation of something.
Or an unreasonable one.
But I thought you had made some of the factors that we had in A, that they had in B.
What are the some recognition about EIR.
Circular.
Yeah, don't you need to know the EIR to know if you're reasonably approximating it?
Well, I thought that I've lost the page.
I think it's
50C, or 50B. It was as the conversation started. Yeah, it's 50B, a rate that reflects the following factors. So in coming up with your methodology, you would use a methodology that considered those factors, and once you had a methodology, you would use it consistently. I thought that's what Daryl was saying.
So you're saying it would be a reasonable approximation if it considered the following factors and was applied consistently period to period.
Yeah,
so to say qualitatively, here's how you determine
it. It would be a reasonable.
It would be, yes.
It would be
including risk for you in this case.
Well, but can we just not mention a range? What we're trying to do is approximate EIR, and these are the things that you do. You don't have to talk about a range.
But someone mentioned about cost site.
Yeah.
If you have this question, what is it?
Well, I would have thought you could always do something like 50B, couldn't you, without it being privileged?
I think this
was
down.
Right, exactly. That's what I was for, in terms of determining discount.
Why is an EIR not available at the portfolio level, or the portfolio average EIR? You know how much interest is being recognized, and you know the carrying value of the portfolio. Well, I think it comes back to, and I think Steve touched on this a little bit earlier, the problem that we are facing is we have accounting systems and we have credit risk management systems. If that was all perfect, one big integration, I think we'd have been back at 2009.
Interest and carrying value in the accounting system?
Well,
I agree that on a loan-by-loan basis, you won't know what the IR is unless you do an awful lot of work. But isn't a reasonable approximation a portfolio average?
Yeah.
Well,
and many banks have in their disclosure yield tables. What is really the average effective interest rate? Man, you have these numbers by portfolio maybe, and put it into your risk system, and then you have to run the calculation. And I think we should say an approximation of EIR, but not say is it reasonable. It should include all an approximation of EIR is sufficient. I think. Then people can do it on a portfolio level, on average, whatever they.
Well, let's let the staff take it forward. All our wonderful suggestions. See what miracles they can perform.
So we're going to strive for an approximation of EIR, is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah.
And come back if it doesn't work.
Don't worry, we will.
Okay, can we move on?
It's
10 to 5.
We'll see that back.
Another paper yet.
Hopefully, the big issue is out of the way. So the second section talks about the clarification and measurement requirements. So the IFB proposed that in measuring expected credit losses, the entity includes reasonable and supportable forecasts of future events and economic conditions. Appendix B provides a detailed extract of this application guidance. The proposal did not require estimates to incorporate forecasts of future conditions over the entire remaining life. Instead, an entity would extrapolate beyond the point where estimates can be made. The FASB discussed a similar point at the September meeting. Their decision is listed in paragraph 54. We received very little feedback on this point, but believe that the board still has to consider areas for convergence at the future meeting, and therefore it is worthwhile to discuss some of these issues. We acknowledge that historical information is an important anchor to measure expected credit losses. However, we...
Sorry to interrupt, but why is the discussion of this now going to help us with convergence later on?
Well, I think it's just important that at this point we do consider the points that's been raised at both, and that we don't come down the line and then have to re-deliberate some points because the board hasn't considered that. If I maybe go through, I don't personally think we end up at different points at this point in time. It is just worthwhile discussing it. So we acknowledge that historical information is an important anchor to measure expected credit losses. However, we recommend that the board carry forward its current guidance on the use of forward-looking information and the fact that we do not expect entities to make specific estimates over the entire life of the instrument, but just as far as reasonable and supportable, and that the board carries forward its guidance on the use of historical information. Secondly, some requested to use prudential models to measure expected credit losses. We recommend that the board confirm the proposals in the ED for the use of regulatory models as a basis for the calculation of expected credit losses. However, it would still require adjustments to meet the objective of the standard. The last point is clarifying the 12-month expected credit losses. Some were unclear of what information this allowance was trying to capture. We recommend that the board include as application guidance paragraph BC63 of the exposure draft, which notes that the 12-month expected credit losses are a portion of lifetime expected credit losses and not lifetime expected credit losses that an entity will incur on financial instruments that it will predict will default in the next 12 months. Those would usually be in stage 2 or 3. And secondly, that it is not the cash shortfall in the next 12 months. With that, I open the floor and discussions of the clarifications on measurement of expected
credit. Any comments on that?
I have only one regarding this sentence. While regulatory models may form a basis for ECL calculation, I agree to that. We're saying regulatory measurement should not be accepted as a measurement, as a measure of ECL. I don't know if we should say it so strict, because it could be. Maybe some will not.
So not automatically.
We should based maybe on the Basel current model, but maybe others will. And we should say it should be as a basis, but if we have to meet the objective, and but not the
other. Other comments?
Mr. Meiner. Yeah. On that, they are moving their PC63 to the R body, but if you see the defined terms of the 12-month expected credit loss, it's quite clear to. If you see that they are repeating your definition in your body.
No, I agree maybe on that point. But I think it's just re-emphasizing that it's what it's not.
Okay. Anybody disagree with this proposal? No? They got it through. Next paper.
All right. So the final paper today, paper 5D, analyzes feedback received on the proposals on the accounting for modified financial assets. It doesn't discuss disclosures for modifications, which will be addressed in a later meeting. The ED proposed that if the contractual cash flows of a financial asset are renegotiated or otherwise modified, and that modification doesn't result in derecognition, then the gross carrying amount of the asset should be recalculated using the original EIR to reflect the modified contractual cash flows, and that corresponding modification gain or loss should then be presented in profit or loss. From that point, to determine whether there has been a significant increase in credit risk, the entity should compare the credit risk at the reporting date following the modification to the credit risk at initial recognition. The vast majority of respondents agreed with the accounting treatment proposed in the ED and felt that the proposals would provide useful information to reflect the economics of a modification. However, they did raise a number of concerns and requested clarification on a few topics. The agenda paper discusses the following issues raised by respondents. First of all, whether the requirements should apply to all modifications or only those performed for credit reasons. Secondly, when a modification results in derecognition. Thirdly, whether an asset derecognized due to a modification should be recognized at stage one again. Whether the symmetry of the model should apply to all modified financial assets. And then there were also some operational concerns and concerns about the presentation requirements. The staff analysis on these matters is presented in paragraphs 19 through 55, and the recommendations are summarized in paragraph 56. In summary, the staff is recommending to confirm the proposals in the ED and not to develop any specific guidance on when modifications result in derecognition. We are also recommending that the application guidance in paragraph B24, which notes that payment performance or other information that indicates the borrower has improved, be clarified to ensure that it is clear it applies to all financial assets and not just those that are past due, as was seen to be implied by the current wording. So given this is just mainly a confirmation of proposals, I'll open it to the board for any discussion or questions.
Comments? Oh, Pat, sorry.
A couple comments, Shannon. One, I'm generally on board with the direction you're going here. I don't have any major objections, subject to the observation you made in your CF, which is you're not going to propose changes to the disclosures dealing with modifications. That, to me, is critical. The decision that the board made in 2010 to remove the disclosures in IFRS 7 was a low point, in my view, in terms of standard setting. Interestingly enough, when I read the enhanced disclosure task force recommendations that came out, I don't know, about a year ago, prominent among them was disclosure of restructured loans, modifications, something that we took out of our literature. So I think it's very important that we should have that. So the information, I think, as long as it's in the disclosures that you're proposing here, or changes you're proposing to make here, I think are fine. I think, frankly, this is a better model if we were to eliminate the symmetry approach, because we're not dealing with fair value. This is expected value, and I think if you have something that's been restructured, you should leave it at a lifetime loss. I think it provides better information. That's the one change that I would make to the suggestions in paragraph 56. But other than that, I can live with that, subject to the disclosures.
Yeah, certainly. And as you know, we discussed in the SGMs, when we come to the point of re-deliberating those disclosure requirements, we currently have no plans to change what's in the ED for the modification disclosures. And I'll definitely keep that in consideration.
Philippe.
I agree with the proposal. I have a question regarding forbearance. What kind of disclosures are going to be provided for forbearance activities under modification, or is it something apart from modification? Because it rings a bell when we had discussions with ESMA some time ago about that we should report and asking for banks to disclose forbearance practices. I read that the European Banking Authority is also about to define the notion of forbearance. So how does it interact with our work?
It's difficult to say, but generally forbearance, we don't deal with forbearance as an accounting topic because it's a regulatory notion. But you know, usually when you've got forbearance, you've got a modification. But I think our modifications may go one step further than what forbearance goes under the regulatory
I think what we're going to need to do, though, Philippe, to your point, is when we look at the modification disclosures and being sensitive to what Pat has said, we're going to need to look and see what ESMA are doing, what the EBA are doing, what the EDTS are doing, and that's a general comment that's been made on the disclosure package in the ED anyway, to make sure that we're sort of cognizant of all the other disclosures going on and we're aware of the context and align where we can and are sensitive to that. So that's something we need to look at.
My point is only to say we cannot ignore that there is a notion of forbearance that does exist. And I don't see how we could issue a standard on impairment that talks about modification and being totally silent about the mere notion of forbearance and not try to explain how it does or doesn't interact.
Maybe we can talk about the relationship.
Any other comments? And I think we're in general agreement.
Here, is that it?
Whoa.
That's early.
You've got trick-or-treating now.